I want to ask a question about the offerings. I was seeing something last night that seemed, I never realized, but it, I know it means something, think big, I can't put the full picture on. The idea that every time there was something that someone did that was bad or wrong or thought was bad, or whatever, they had to make an offering. And what they always offered was an animal of some sort that was a perfect type of Christ, and they offered it to God. And it just occurred to me the significance of that. You do something, and you make an offering of Christ to God, typologically. And the same thing, we do the same thing. I think it ties into the that three or four offerings are to God, the rest are to man. But there's something about you're offering Christ out of your own self to the Father. You know what I'm saying?
Well, but I think that you could quickly move into heresy there.
Yeah, you
did. Scary.
Well, it sounded good.
Yeah, it sounds real.
Sounds good to me.
Rather than you making, Christ is both the offerer and the offered. Mm-hmm. If you think you're making the offering, then you'll gain righteousness from it. Mm-hmm. So you, in the typology, the basis is right that in the offerings have to be made many, many times a day, every day.
Yeah.
But it wasn't always an animal, remember. For the lower grades of apprehension, there was flour.
Flour, yeah. But always something that typified
an aspect of Christ. Aspect but of it was Christ that made the offering. So it takes even that part of you out of the picture.
Okay.
And so it's always just seeing him as being the offerer, the offered, the priest that accepts it, and see him as unto the Father. And it moves you farther out of the picture and gives you more understanding. But if you consider that you are doing any portion of it, then you'll end up in heresy. Then you'll end up with the Benny Hinn's and the Tiltons and all these guys that are God, they're goofy. But I say this because you and Judy, above all people, you had 2 years of the claim it theology, and so you have to, I'm glad you went through that, but you have to be on your guard. But you have to be on your guard of it because it's always going to try to make you. It's gonna try to make you the little God. It's gonna, you know.
I don't feel like I was stepping into any of those arenas. It just was. I just wondered the significance that the effect. What I thought the effect is it establishes the offerer relationship with God, because there's so many times a day that offerings have to be made, and what that offering is a connection to God.
But even see that though. Even you have to take it one step further. Even see that the offerer, the one who's making the offering, is Christ.
Yeah, that's significant, obviously.
Right, because it takes.
You're not even ceremonially going to do
you,
it.
Right, we couldn't make the ceremonial offering. Even we can't meet those standards.
We can't do. We couldn't come 600 miles within the tabernacle.
Yeah, what you're saying is, as these things come into your life, as you're moving through the day or something, then it's an opportunity for you to remember, okay, gosh, Christ has made this offering of himself, and it's all taken care of, and these trespasses and sins, I think I'm going to get weird about, I don't have to.
Right.
And as you move through the day, that's what you think about.
And it's important to recognize that. Do we have any cough drops anywhere? I'm losing my voice.
They're sounding weird.
I've got some peppermint.
I've got a pretty young peppermint.
Is how many times a day the offerings were made. The one common denominator of the heresies, and is that you just have to do it once.
I like what you said, this link about it's not even us making the offering. But I was trying to tie it into, those offerings were all bulls and goats and flour and different things. But for us, we don't offer that type of stuff. But we offer what we see from that of Christ. And And then I guess in remembrance, kind of like John was saying.
We stop and see that it has already been done.
Yeah, it's finished, it's complete.
And that's why it's always going to be the renewal of our mind. It's not going to be anything changed. We always want something to change. We want there to be a change in the way we perceive things, a sensory perception. And that'll never happen. As Peter said, all things continue the same as it was from the beginning of creation.
Well, isn't the change from the renewal of the mind? I mean, once that happens, the change...
Nothing external is going to change.
Right. Outward.
Always it's just going to change here where the warfare is. It's never with somebody else. It's always in here. Oh, I'm losing my voice real quickly here.
Boy, you're talking about the offerings. That's one thing. It's like if I was gonna, if I do a project, I need a picture. If I have to sit down and read the directions, I can do it, but if I had to do it every time, I get real. It's just not the way I approach a problem. But when I think about these offerings, and you got doves, and you got it's like I can't ever get, they must be, I've heard you say there are levels of apprehension in there, but it doesn't. So like it doesn't always mean.
Well,
it's not full picture to me. I mean, how that happens with us, or how our levels are. Or the necessity for, you got to have a RAM for this one. You got to have, this is big time, and this.
Yeah, but it's never worked. It's never like that. It's not that you had to have a RAM for a big sin, that was never the case. The size of the sin or the trespass wasn't.
It's right. Like who you were.
It's who you were is what determined the size of the offering. Too much has been given, much will be required. That's why in spirit, as we apprehend more, then we will be given more. Now, you don't realize it here, but, even in our limited apprehension here, in terms of what the finished work of Christ is, especially in the offerings and in the feasts, we have been given 100 million more times more than anything that I've ever seen anyplace else. And so, by that same process, then, we will be given much more. Now, the problem of studying the offering, let me go to the blackboard. You guys go over here somewhere. If we can just for a minute set aside the waters. Down here, out of sight, is the tabernacle. Now, we can't even get to know that Jesus Christ is the way, until we get... Well, actually, that's not true. The tabernacle begins right here. All this stuff is outside the camp, for the most part. But I want to talk in terms of shame a minute. How this here relates to shame. One of the things that psychologists have gotten all confused about in the last few years, and maybe they never knew the difference, was the difference between guilt and shame. Guilt is something, you did something, you feel sorry for it, and there has to have a redemption. You make a payment, there's some atonement made for guilt. Because guilt is something you do, some mistake you made, something you've done, so something can be done about it. You can confess and get forgiveness. You can apprehend Jesus Christ and get, but because it's a mistake you've made. But for some of you, shame, toxic shame, is much more. It's what do you do for the thing that you don't even deserve to live? What do you do about shame? What can be done for shame? So all the talk about the blood of Christ and
all the waters of purification, the ashes, the red heifer, the waters of jealousy and all that. That all is great, nice sense, but what about shame? Now, I want to oversimplify something here, but guilt, the trespass offering is for guilt. The sin offering is for shame.
Because it's a who you are being.
And that's why there's so much confusion between guilt and shame. Meaning you and individually, and you individually. You know, you say, oh, I made this mistake, and I made that mistake, and I did this, and I did that.
So shame is more related, guilt is more related to our relationships vis-a-vis man. Shame more vis-a-vis our relationship of God or our gods.
No. Shame.
Well, if shame deals with sin, and guilt trespasses are guilt.
It's the core of who you are.
No, trespass can be against God as well as against man. You're getting confused. You got the metaphor mixed.
Well, there's no
mixed.
Problem with that. I mean, that's, yeah.
Okay.
Getting confused.
There's something that has transpired in but that causes you to worship against your will. Now, that's what shame does. Shame causes you to enter into a state of worship against your will. It causes you to bow down to the molten images where everything in you says, I don't want to do that. The more you try to fight against it, the more susceptible to them you will become, because you're giving it more and more breath. So you must suspect that most of the people that will come and become believers, by definition, will have to have been shame-based in their life, because it's only those that can feel shame are the ones that can repent. There's a whole world of people out there who at any given moment of time, maybe it's 25% of the population or more, that have no capacity to feel shame. There's a large percentage of the people. And normally they become very successful. And so when you try to express and talk about the universality of Jesus Christ, unless you've taken into consideration guilt and shame, it won't make any sense. It's like, you run into some idiot like me and says, well, you need Jesus as your personal savior. Are you saved? And I say, saved from what? I didn't want to, what does that mean, saved? Because I hadn't known the capacity, if I'd known it, it was so long ago that I forgot about it, I'd covered over it so well that there was no shame. So shame, there really should be two different words, and there probably is somewhere, but there should be the kind of shame that makes you human, and that's the kind of shame that's good, that defines your boundaries, that makes you know you're not little gods, that makes you know you're not like, what these idiots teach. But there's then the shame that's the immobilizing shame, the nuclear shame, the toxic shame, the pathological shame. But that immobilizes you, and that causes you. This is the shame that causes you to worship without you wanting to.
All of those things seem to be so mixed up in us, at least to me. You know, guilt and shame and toxic and all that. You know, it's just all a blood.
Well, that's why in order to have power over it, you have to be able to name it. And that's why, in order to name it, you've got to have some arena. I'm not saying to be saved, you have to name it, but I'm saying that to apprehend the fullness of what the sin and trespass offering are, you have to be able to name it.
Yeah, it's a minister to somebody.
Right.
You've got to be able to distinguish it between this big mass of something.
Right.
And that's what's hard.
Well, that's the reason for the pre-Passover hot seats this time, is this so that we will have temperance. And we studied last night massively in Bananas that the works of the flesh are these. Boom. It says, well, we forget. Before you get to the works of the flesh in Galatians 5, you get Galatians 4, which is casting out the bondwoman and her son. For us, the bondwoman is your mind. And the son is the fruit of the mind. You can't cast out the bondwoman without casting out the son. So all the little projects and things that you think of and the ideas, that's the bondwoman. The ideas are the bondwoman's son. They have to be cast out so that you can enter into the state of abandonment. And you have to want to cast them out. You have to stop. You've had to have gotten to a position where you no longer, you're not trying to prove to anybody that you have a mind. You're not trying to prove to anybody that you've got a bondwoman. I mean, do you understand how, I mean, there's so many people in this group of people around here that spend most of their life trying to prove they've got a bondwoman. Well, nobody cares. It's time to cast her out. You know, it doesn't matter if the bondwoman, you know, was in the 1/100th of 1 percentage point of some class.
A Mensa bondwoman.
I was in the upper 50% of my high school graduating class.
Now, would that be the same as like the upper third?
It's way up there, it seems.
Anyway, the point of it is, the bondwoman is nothing. So we have to cast out the bondwoman and her son. Now, this, from the Bible standpoint, the Bible calls this carnal mind flesh. You understand that? And so it says that the works of, and again, it's talking about the bondwoman. The works of the flesh are these. And it lists all the works of the flesh. It doesn't matter what they look like, and it doesn't matter in whose name they are. The works of the flesh are all of those things. Now, most of the time, the works of the flesh are, the power, the drive for the works of the flesh are to overcome or to overshadow or to prove that shame doesn't exist. That's the drive. For 90% of the world, what they call ambition, I call shame. That's the Zig Ziglar theology. Have you ever read, did you read?
I'm on Zig's manual.
I went to a Zig breakfast.
Did you read Joe Bob's Cosmic Wisdom of Joe Bob Briggs? You gotta read the Cosmic. Joe Bob's friend, Arnold, went to see Zig Ziglar. And Arnold didn't have any arms.
Yeah.
And that's all he wanted was arms. And Zig Ziglar kept saying, all you have to do is visualize what you want. Go for it. See it. You succeed in God's name. Go for it. And Arnold says, well, all I want is arms.
That's John.
He's a sick person.
Pretty.
It's one of the best things he's ever written. I love it. Fucking Zig. Ziggy, baby. Come to me. Come back at me. love to get Zig on a talk show. Oh, God, would I love
it. Your whole audience
is probably so old.
As I said in the past, shame is masqueraded as guilt, and guilt has so strongly dominated the language, in both religious and secular language, since the Puritan era, that we really got them all confused. But guilt is about behavior. You failed a test. You screwed your best friend's wife. You did something wrong. You broke a vase. You did something wrong, right?
It's almost like a red herring, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, no, no. Now, if the guilt is strong enough, you feel that a debt must be repaid, an atonement of some kind is made. Boom, buddy, boom, de, boom. You know, you can spend your life, so you're still paying. But shame is about not being good enough. Shame expects rejection, not because of what you have done, but because of what you are. Okay, you understand that guilt is about what you do. Normal shame is healthy. We talked about that. It's what sets your boundaries. It's what causes you to be able to repent. You know you're slightly defect. There's a defect there, but it's almost humorous.
Well, it makes it possible to be part of a group.
Yeah, it? But it's things like you don't feel good enough, but it's just for a time. You understand? Yeah. It's like you're.
Well, it's like you're a bumbling fool for a moment,
yeah,
to everybody,
like, mm-hmm. Right?
But you're not all the time because you know.
Right. You go your first dance, and you go ask the girl for a dance, and she says no.
Yeah.
Or then, for some of you, you go and you ask the girl for a dance, and she says yes.
And you really.
Then you're on the dance floor, and you can't dance.
And you don't know how to dance.
And then you get up and the teacher calls you up front to make a speech and your fly's open.
Or you call the teacher by her first name and she says, don't ever do that.
Yeah, or something like that. Anyway, but it's that you're not good enough, but it's just for a time. It's not anything you did, but it's just it's not good enough for a time. And that's healthy. It happens to all of us. And that kind of shame is easy to deal with. So we got guilt. Now we got normal shame. You got those two straight?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now we come. Now, these in-time shame experiences come from the idea of rejection, of...
In-time.
Just for a time. They come from failure, from rejection, from being confused, or, you know...
Being insensitive and you recognize yeah. you've been rude and... Things like that.
Yeah.
Embarrassment. It's like embarrassment, like a form of this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or time down.
But they include that what they have is this feeling like you've crossed some hidden boundary line. You know, you've crossed over a boundary of impropriety, or you farted in church, or you know. There's a boundary of impropriety.
Sure. Or you talked about farting in church.
But you've created a boundary. I mean you found your own boundaries, and then every once in a while, in order to find your boundary, you have to step over it every once in a while. Do you understand?
Yeah.
So that's healthy, that's fine, it's wonderful. But there's another thing, and it's called pathological shame or toxic shame. And it's a sense of being defective to the core. Of not belonging anywhere. It's a feeling not of having crossed a forbidden boundary, but that you were born across the forbidden boundary. That there is no worth. And you spend your entire life trying to convince yourself that you have some worth. But at the core, you don't believe it. You're alienated from yourself. that's where some of you are. And so all of the talk about all of this great stuff up here about access and blood and mysteries doesn't do any good because it hasn't touched the shame-based person. It's only touched this one. It's touched the person that this. You know, when you become alienated, you know what that means? The process of being alienated is this thing that occurs very early in time, and it's when there's a split in you, and you know that this core being is worthless. And so this other being, this masquerade takes over, and that's the entire life is this masquerade, trying to avoid letting anybody else see that core being. And so all of the stuff that you learn and hear and see, especially God stuff, is all covered. It's all to this fantasy being that you've created. It's this little Ben or somebody, you know. And so little Ben here becomes a Christian, and little Ben becomes, he's got some ideas and understand. But then you're always exposed when you're blindsided. To be blindsided is what exposes that Ben isn't really real. And this other core being jumps up and goes for the jugular. Now, our role as believers in a community of love is to integrate those two so there's only one. Now, that takes a long, long time.
It seems like that can take two forms. One, that would make you a very successful person, or a very striving person, to, you know, because they're all like little offerings that you keep doing, or ways of dealing with the, you know, covering over this basic sense of no worth. And the other is, you know, this fuck it, I don't really care kind of thing, that so you never do anything, and you just have a bad attitude.
So you understand that this, back to the guilt and shame thing, we are guilty of something, but we are ashamed of myself. You see the difference?
Well, this is still regular shame.
No, both of them. Either one of them, regular shame and nuclear shame, or pathological shame, you're both ashamed of yourself. But with the regular shame, it's only for a time.
Isn't the evidence, sometimes the evidence of being ashamed of yourself that you're ashamed of someone else? It's like that kind of
sure
keys off that you might be.
Okay. As I said, guilt is about something you did that you shouldn't have, or about something you thought that you shouldn't have thought. And for guilt, there's a solution. You need to make amends, you need to confess, you need to be forgiven. Each group has their own little rituals. We have our little rituals that we go through over guilt. We don't seek forgiveness, confession, and confess your fault one to another that you might be healed. So for guilt, there's a solution. But as I said earlier, what do you do about shame? What does shame require? It requires nothing less than you be a different person than you are. That you not be ugly. That you have a different body. That you not be stupid. That you not be a failure. It requires that you be a different person. Can you understand that?
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I have no trouble with
it. Huh?
I have no trouble understanding it.
The only real thing at the moment of the experience of shame is that you become non-existent. That's the only feeling. And when you feel the shame, the common cliches, the language is revelatory. It says, I wish I could have dug a hole. I was so ashamed, I wished I could die. I wish I would have disappeared. Understand? again, the regular normal shame, you may feel that every once in a while, but for this pathological shame, it snowballs. And every time you're confronted with the same or similar gestures or voice patterns or stimuli, then it piles again. But you re-experience the first one. And then you pile on an infinite number of times over the years until slowly but surely it's like a snowball rolling downhill. That's why this condition becomes worse as you get older. Pathological shame doesn't improve with time, it becomes worse. Now, the thing that the transaction that has to occur is you have to return in your mind to that first point and see that that first point was where you felt separate, you felt a death. And you have to mourn for that death. So it loses its power. That's why there's the liturgy of mourning. It is really over this shame issue, if we could see it. That's why the scriptures define, or this Talmud defines, all the liturgies of mourning. That's the only way to you have to go. You have to, you know, you may not have to go back to the, you know, you may have forgotten. You may not be able to get to the point, to the one that caused this. But you can get to one that's fairly close back there. And you can mourn for the damn thing and get it over.
And you mourn for the death of yourself.
Well, death, whatever death it is that you perceived.
At that time.
Because, again, shame always has to do with this idea that you're offering, you yourself weren't accepted, therefore you must be dead.
Different points of shame in my own life about one. I took on a to be like, you know, to get into drugs or, you know, wear my hair long, wear an earring, and got into that whole thing. And as I was sitting here thinking about, it's not that I like so much of that stuff. I mean, and after years and years of feeling like, you know, it's because I think I felt like I couldn't do. I wasn't smart enough to do the other way, you know, and at some point I thought I was, I just wasn't intelligent enough, because then there became a place whenever all that other was, you know, dropped off, even after years, you know, then I began to see signs of where I was trying to make up for, or still compete, or, you know, it's like I put on a false covering. That didn't really make any sense.
Yeah, and there's all kinds of...
There's an overlay that happened, and I was thinking about other people, like, you know, particular Lanny, you see him now, he looks like a different man than he did when he came here, and he's doing some stuff, you know, he's taking a course, mild school, but course, and doing some things he never thought he could do, but he had this appearance when he first came of being... not smart enough, and I think that I hadn't thought about much about this, how, you know, I could really, we could dress ourselves up or down, whatever.
Well, that's what we're addressing with regard to, well, anyway, the dress thing is like with Jim, and it doesn't make any sense to your mind,
He wants to just look bad.
But it's, or with Paul, or with... But it's I know it's shame-based. Like, and people that are shame-based, if they suspect that you can see through them, they won't look you in the eye. I mean, they'll avoid you at all cost, in fact. Now, what we have to acknowledge is, yes, that death did occur. It was a righteous death. We were making the wrong offering at the wrong time to the wrong person, to the wrong God. And truly understand the sin offering, then we can see that.
What do you mean? You said it was a righteous death. You mean it was a correct death? It was a deserved death?
It was deserved.
Appropriate.
appropriate.
So you, it was more evil than...
Or pure evil, so because you think...
This is the difference between... I'm trying to get this... Well, why are you not a victim in this? Because, and there's something together. I mean, it was that nature, that first offering...
Was evil.
Even if you were a child,
still
was so intrinsically evil, it had to be smushed.
It was the offering of the curse.
The offering that was rejected that caused the shame.
Yeah,
right.
It began in the first place.
Right. So there's no victimhood even at 7 months or 18 months. It's all pure evil.
It was the nature of Adam.
What was it, 7 months or 18 months?
Well, that's normally when you start becoming, you start making these silly offerings.
Oh, as a child.
But anyway.
What are we going to do? I was thinking this will probably start out as people talking about things that cause them shame that they haven't really talked about before.
Even if they've talked about it.
Even
if they've talked about it before. What you have to do is, instead of making it these long, boring, endless lists, oh, I'm ashamed of this, I'm ashamed of that. When I was in the first grade, I saw my mother take a pee, and I was guilty about that, and I was ashamed of this. Get rid of all that bullshit. Huh?
Don't make fun of
me. And go for the jugular. Mm-hmm. Find the three or four, at the most, points of shame. But the way the body language, the way it's described, will define whether or not they believe they're a victim. If they believe they're a victim, then you have to go for the jugular. Now, what we can do if you want, we've never really done the shame thing as stealth. We can do this as stealth before we do it as the other groups, if you want to.
No, thanks.
Thanks,
but no thanks. I don't care to go through it twice.
But anyway, bottom line. The shame, the normal shame that you can end up making fun of, and it doesn't bug you, and it's just.
Yeah.
But the pathological shame is the shame that
people kill.
He's permanent defect or something. That's so weird.
And that the only solution is the cross. Therefore, the only solution is the sin offering. Trespass. You see, guilt covers the trespass offering. Shame is the sin offering. Look in your notes and go through that. The offering. We see by one offering he hath perfected forever them that are sanctified. Okay?
Yeah.
But this thing, this core, this thing at your the core of your being that says, I don't have a right to be here. So I've had to create this significant other here. Dances, runs around. This one is child's play. That's a puff of smoke. This is the one that you have to get to.
You were discussing last night when you were talking about this, you were discussing the works of the flesh. And you're probably saying these are tied.
Yeah. The works of the flesh are all of the things that flesh does to avoid shame.
Okay.
To avoid the recognition of what I just said. But this is, it's really, you know, and again, you have to see that it doesn't matter whether you put God's name on it or not. The works of the flesh are manifest, which are these: adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lasciviousness, idolatry, witchcraft, hatred, variance, emulations, wrath, strife, seditions, heresies, envyings, murders, drunkenness, violence, and such like, of which I tell you before, as I've told you in time past. They which do such things shall not inherit the kingdom of God. No matter what the mind does, it's the works of the flesh. That's why the mind of Christ is the mind of emptying, taking no thought for tomorrow. And that's what's so vital that you see this. You got to, at the core, you've got to see that the reason that the works of the flesh are there is, and the reason the plans, the reason the objective, all these things, are, there's a desperate attempt to prove to yourself that you have a right to be. Now, again, it's hard for a fish to describe the ocean. I communicate it. It's hard for some of you to think about this because it's all you've ever known. So you've got to, the alienation, you have to have the courage to stop the alienation, to integrate the two beings into one. And you know whether or not there's two of you or not. I'm losing my voice. I don't want to talk anymore.
You know, I just, sometimes I think back at different periods when I just, man, I hated my life so much and just abhorrence of living that, you know, there was a continual, and I thought it would never, that it would never be any different. You know, it was just that, it's that kind of thing that, yeah, I could go out and I could enjoy myself, I could do this, but then you go back to your alone place and you're alone and you're disgusted with everything that you tried to do to be better, you know. And I'm, you know, in that sense, I'm glad that you know, I knew that place, but I'm equally thankful, if not more, that you know, life didn't have to be like that.
No.
And how many more people, I mean, live like that? I mean, I know that they are. They're living like that.
Well, it's interesting when to go through the scriptures, especially in the Proverbs, to see how many times shame is used.
I haven't thought about that.